Okay, so glad you guys are here. I'm going to start us off with a little prayer. Oh Lord, I want to thank you for bringing us together this evening. Thank you for giving us the courage and the willingness to dig a little deeper, to open our minds and our hearts to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to recognize our powerlessness, our physical craving, and to acknowledge the need to build a relationship with you. Please open our hearts, open our minds, guide my words, and help them to land on willing spirits. In your name I pray, amen. So our set-aside prayer, we're still looking at the physical craving. God, please enable me to set aside everything I think I know so that I can have an open mind and a new experience. Help me to see the truth about my physical craving, what happens to me after I take the first drink or drug or substance. Today, we're going to be looking at Bill's story, the first 8 pages. And at the beginning of his story, it tells us to use the first half of Bill's story, page 1 through 8, as a tool to try and relate your alcoholic life to Bill's. Putting aside the differences, look at the similarities and underline what you can relate to. How he felt, how he thought, and how he drank. So tonight, you're going to hear Jason's story. The way that I'm going to relate Bill's story to you this evening is going to be by talking about the things that I've underlined and how they're very apparent in my life in order for me to recognize this level of powerlessness, this level of unmanageability. It's important for me to be honest. It's important for me to be true about it. Some of the things are painful. I don't know exactly what's going to come out. I'm going to do my very best to allow God to speak through me and for me, removed of my ego and my worry of how I look to you, how I sound to you, what you think of me. Because if I do any of that, then I wouldn't be being honest. This is something that should become very personal to each and every one of you, something that you discuss in depth in your groups as to what you underlined, how you relate in the form of examples from your life. Honest, painful, real examples. Bill's story becomes each and every one of your stories. First going through this, it was tough for me to relate. It was hard for me to see my own powerlessness, my own problem with drinking, drugging, relationships, until I went through this way, underlined things and actually took a hard look at my own life and my own experience. And coming out of these 8 pages, if we're not a little bit uncomfortable, ashamed, feeling a little guilty, then we may want to revisit these pages. Because these are the things that, this is a portion of the insanity that I'm going to take to God in my second step. These are the things that I need to acknowledge. Although they may not be current in my life, they do need to be constantly lifted up to this power, because this insanity turns so, it returns in my life so quickly. So here we go. We'll see where God takes me here. So it says, war fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew. Young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizen took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. Very lonely in my life. As I touch on these sentences or words that I have underlined, they're not going to be sequential in the sense of a timeline, because I'm going to touch on them as they come up in this book. The loneliest I have ever been in my life was laying next to my wife in bed. It was a very, very painful place for me to be. Very uncomfortable. I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't know what to do. Today I know that it can be acknowledged, it can be lifted up to God, and that I don't have to treat that loneliness the way that I have in the past. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is never forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Ominous warning which I failed to heed. So as I look at my life and the ominous warnings, when I was 15 years old, I overdosed on gypsum weed, which is a root, and it's a weed that grows in eastern San Diego County and probably other parts of the country. It's 10 times more potent than peyote. The Indians use it in ceremonies before they went to war. I thought it was a good idea that I get together with my friends and we eat this root. We ate this root. We all got sick. I ended up in Children's Hospital for 5 days, and so did seven of my friends. My little brother, who was 2 years younger than me, ate enough to kill a 2,000-pound horse. When horses eat the root, they run until their heart explodes. Sure. Very, very powerful hallucinogen. Very, very traumatic experience. Very scary. Within a few weeks, I was not only selling acid again, but eating it regularly, going to school in high school, sophomore year, and feeling like a big shot telling my story to my friends of how I overdosed on gypsum weed. So that was an ominous warning, one of the many, but probably one of the most important that I failed to heed in my life, 15 years old. Oh. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader. I've always fancied myself a leader. I got the leadership award in eighth grade. I got leadership awards in high school. The problem with my leadership that's been given to me by God is that I've never utilized it the way it was meant to be. I've used it to dominate you, emotionally abuse you, to get what I want in life,
Oh.
to make you do what I want you to do. And today I recognize that though I have been given a gift, I've never used it in the way God intended. Because when I use it in the way God intends, it's scary, it's uncomfortable. It means that I have to destroy my ego in the moment, be altruistic, have compassion, have empathy, and at the same time, guide and lead people to a better place in their life through my own experience. So that's what I'm recognizing today, and one of the reasons why I'm attempting to lead this workshop. For had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. So I've always relied on my skills to lead, to dominate, to change your way of thinking to get where I needed to be in life. Personal gain is what I use my leadership for. Never out of love. Never with a true desire to help. That attitude that I've carried around my whole life, especially prior to walking through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I relied on as a crutch to get me where I needed to be. Bill says, imagined it would place him at the head of vast enterprises. I come from a broken home, a poor family, apartment kid, and I was sure that this gift of gab and this leadership ability and my good looks and all of these ridiculous aspects that I took advantage of and never truly utilized were going to get me where I needed to be. And the only place it got me was full of pain, emptiness, lonely, inability to control my drinking and my drugging, and in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took a night law course and obtained employment. An investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. So I left my home at 18 years old, moved out with my girlfriend, never looked back, never asked for help. Walked through life with this attitude of I am better than each and every one of you, talking about my family. I'm going to prove it to you. And when you need something, you're going to come to me and I am going to play the parent role in my mother's life, in my father's life, in my brother's life without ever taking a look at myself with this attitude of, I don't need your love. I don't need your help because real men take care of themselves. These are things I recognize in Bill's story that helped me to truly get to a place of unmanageability. And they're different. The same sentence is different for each and every one of us, but it is so important for us to be rigorously honest about, even if it's in private, rigorously honest about how this particular sentence or phrase pertains to the life that I led that got me here. Because if I don't truly see it, I will not truly surrender to help. And I may live in this delusion that I'm doing all of this work to recover, wondering why I can never really get to this place that I think I'm supposed to be. So my work took me about Wall Street. Little by little, I became interested in the market. So I grew up doing drugs from the time I was 11 years old, drinking from the time I was 13, living in this small eastern San Diego County town. Everybody did drugs. And I became interested in the market and the people that were selling drugs, the people that I was buying from. I've had a job since I was 13 years old. And the first reason I got the job was so I could buy my cigarettes, my alcohol, and my drugs. My work, many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? Come from a poor home, want to come up, fancy myself a leader. I'm going to prove to this whole world that I'm better than you. Why don't I just start selling drugs? Because some of these guys are walking around flashing cash all the time. I want that. I want to be that. I want you to see that I have made it in life. I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. My alcoholic and drug life was the only life I knew. It was the only normal life. And all of these places that my superficial leadership skills had taken me were conceived through being mostly high. That was my thing. From the time I woke up to the time I went to sleep for over 30 years. If one was to drink the way that I smoked weed, you would die. That's how much it was. Out of control. Every day, all day. Then the drinking progressed and then other things came into my life. So the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. By the time I completed the course, I knew that law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. So as I became interested in drugs, selling drugs, because it gives me the power to be better than you and to have what you want and to have what you need and to make this transactional meeting where I'm walking away with money, I became really interested in it and it gripped me. I got hit by a car when I was 2 years old in a car wash, run over in the car wash. My parents were young. They were 20 years old at the time. This was right before they got a divorce. They sued the car wash. They ended up with $8,000, I believe. Put it in a fund for me to get when I was 18. The day I turned 18, I went to the courthouse, got a check, bought a truck, bought a pound of wheat. I was off and running. That was it. From the time I was 18 years old till 8 years ago at 42, I sold drugs the whole time till I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Growing up poor, thinking that I have been slighted, shorted of this life that I see other people living, the level of envy that has driven me my whole life, I see today has made my life so unmanageable, made me so judgmental, made me never satisfied. I still suffer from that today. The defects of character that I carry around that I can do nothing about, I have to constantly be aware of and lift up to God. Because they live in me, removed from this power. And there's a part of me that fights this power all the time. And I have to acknowledge that and lift it up. So out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. So little did I know, I'm building this lifestyle, this attitude that is going to turn right back around and cut me and my family to ribbons. Almost destroy everything that I have. Force me to this place of desperation that I finally go and ask for help, broken and beaten and willing to do anything. But I had no idea that this weapon was being forged. See, I was creating this life of success. I was creating this life of superiority. And it was okay because I deserved it. Because I'm entitled to it. And I began to prove it. I've worked my whole life since I was a little kid. I started a family at 19 years old. I adopted a kid who was 3 years old. I got married. I had another kid. I started a business at 24. My wife doesn't work. I'm selling the drugs to the whole town. I'm drinking every day because I deserve it. Now all of a sudden, I've created this life that I think is wonderful. Completely minimizing the pain that I'm causing. The lack of emotional connections that I have, the lack of empathy that I have, the lack of compassion for you that I have. Because all that matters to me is putting money in my pocket and putting drugs and alcohol in my system. And I will do whatever it takes to get that. Whatever it takes. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities. Then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagine that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. So Bill's sharing with us in these first 8 pages his journey to the bottom, his journey to unmanageability, his journey to recognize something is off and I need help. And his story tells us how he did well and did good and then slowly starts to fall off. And alcohol eventually becomes his master. And in my life, drugs, alcohol, women became my master. I didn't know how to live without them. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. I never spent a minute sober. And I was married and I had a family. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sides car stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and 3 huge volumes of financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. So I started a business at 24. I was able to buy a home the following year. And within 2 years, I have young children, a business that's just starting to take off, and I have to start growing weed on my property, in my sheds, with my family here. This was, mind you, well before it was legal, well before it was okay, well before you couldn't get in trouble. So my attitude of always have to have more, always going to find a way. And what began to happen was the business starts suffering and the energy and the attitude into the manufacturing and the selling of drugs combined with drinking all the time becomes such a priority that they're so intertwined, I can't even tell them apart. And again, this is my alcoholic and drug addict life being my only normal one, the only thing I know. And I didn't see anything wrong with it, mind you. Nothing. Not at the time. Not, I didn't see anything wrong with it until I was in the quicksand and walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just running. I was going. And my attitude to the family was do as I do, not, or do as I say, not as I do. I was very harsh. I wasn't physically abusive, but I'm very mentally abusive. I don't see black when I drink. I see red. I didn't drink to black out, but I got into this place where I'm going to scream at you. I'm going to yell at you. I'm going to make you cry. I'm going to emotionally abuse you. I'm going to break you down. I'm going to prove to you that what I'm doing is okay and justified. And I'm going to force you to get in that corner and stay right here with me. And if you don't like it, get out. And that's attitude to the whole family. See, these are the painful things that I was talking about. Although they're not apparent in my life today, it is very, very important for me to recognize these things, to talk about these things, to bring these things to light. Because if the first step is the only step that I can do perfectly, then I very well better be able to go to this place and honestly look at my unmanageability at any moment, at any time. Honestly, look at my powerlessness at any moment, at any time. Otherwise, the further I get away from these things that I'm sharing with you guys tonight, the more I can have this attitude of maybe I don't need this anymore. Maybe I'm okay. And God forbid, maybe I fall back into this attitude that I'm trying so hard to be free from. Excuse me. So for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. So there were times when I had plenty of money. I had drawers full of cash. I had work. I had employees. And I thought I had arrived. I'm doing better than my brother who's living in an apartment with his wife. I'm doing better than my mother who's been divorced 3 times. I'm doing better than my father who's still sticking needles in his arms and doesn't even have a home. What a delusion. Part of this process has brought me to a place to understand that I am no better. And it's one of the hardest things I've ever had to come to terms with. And see that. We talk so much about the physical craving, which is of utmost importance and the first part of our first step. But please understand that in this chapter and in the next one, there is a solution that we're going to go through. There's so much more. There's so much more. See through it, read into it, understand it. Bill's about to tell us next week about how he recovered from all this madness. It has nothing to do with the physical craving. We are hammering home the physical craving, but we're also understanding that relating to each and every portion of this book, these paragraphs, transfers to us having a real experience. It's really the only way that hard-headed, self-centered, selfish people like ourselves can allow this to work in our life. So my judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important, exhilarating part of my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. So I want you all to consider the friends that you had prior to coming through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and how many of those friends today are not just still in your life, but they're ones that you can talk to, be honest with. They respect your recovery, what you're going through, and you truly connect with them. For me, I have one out of probably 20, and these were over 20-year friends in my life. So I definitely made a host of fair weather friends. And what it's showing me, just as Bill's mentioning here, is that that life I was leading is no life. God intends me to connect with other people. God intended me to be honest and to relate with other people and to help other people and be service to other people. And I never lived that until I came here. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. So as I got older, probably about 18, I shared with you that I started using about 11, drinking about 13. But by the time I was about 19, the drinking was every day. From the time I was about 13, smoking weed was every day. When I get my hands on it, by the time I had money in my pocket, all the time. But again, what's important for me to recognize, I never saw that as a problem. That never bothered me. I was living in such a delusion, destroying everything around me. I had no idea. I didn't care. That's how selfish I was. I didn't care. And if you didn't like it, then you didn't need to be in my life. And that was my attitude. The reminiscences of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity. For loyalty to my wife helped me at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. So my experience with that is the complete opposite of Bill's. I mentioned to you guys when I first started reading that the loneliest I've ever been is in bed next to my wife. Okay. The unhappy scenes in my sumptuous apartment, my home, my children grew up around screaming and yelling almost every day. Whether it was in the morning as I was off on my busy day, whether it was in the afternoon when I came home to take it out on her, whether it was a minor argument that turned into an explosion, whether it was me drinking too much, seeing red, taking it out on everybody. It was horrible. It was horrible. I underlined real infidelity because that's what happened in my life. And in 2012, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 2018. In 2012, I decided that I was going to have an affair. So I found a woman that I manipulated, emotionally abused, took advantage of. She was 16 years younger than my wife. And I had this affair. I've never been in so much pain in my life. I could not make a decision. I ripped my family apart. I moved out of my house. My oldest son was 20 at the time, and this woman was 23. There was so much pain and suffering going on. I did things like have a nervous breakdown, come crawling back home literally on my knees, crying to my boys and my wife, promising them that I would never leave again, and if I ever left this house, it would be in a box. And then proceeded the very next day to leave again and go do the exact same thing. That's the kind of pain and suffering that was going on in my home that I was causing. Then I proceeded to tell my wife about affairs I had had prior to try and push her away from me because I couldn't make the decision because I was so afraid of being alone. To try and force her to leave me. I told her I had an affair while she was pregnant with our son. 16 years prior. Who does that? A selfish, self-centered, arrogant, egotistical person who has no compassion or empathy. Doesn't know themselves, doesn't know how to exist in this life, doesn't know how to connect. Unmanageability. Unmanageability. Powerless over that whole situation, thinking the whole time I was in control. Horrible. Horrible. And mind you, that didn't bring me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent 6 years after that trying to fix it myself. Moving back home with alcohol, counseling, screaming, yelling. I said things to my wife like, I cannot stop thinking about that girl. I need to go get help. Who does that? Who even stays together behind that? I don't know. Madness. All the while my children are looking at me like, Dad, dude, what are you doing? I have my kids tell me, make a decision, Dad. Just get out of here. Enough's enough. You're torturing us. You're killing Mom. What are you doing? Oh, no, no. I'm going to move back home. And if you don't like it, you can get out of my house. And we're going to fix it with a 30-pack of Bud Light every night. We're going to be hitting that bong. And we're going to talk this out. And that went on for 6 years. Till I finally ended up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Beaten. Broken. See, that's Jason's story you guys are hearing. This is how I relate to Bill's 8 pages here. This is how I recognize I belong right here. And that I'm still tormented and tortured to this day. And there's so much healing to be done. So, there was some real infidelity in my life. 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country. My wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. So this business that I created is giving me freedom. I have people working for me. They're making money. I go do whatever I want. That's what got me into trouble with the affair. I'm going to go play cards. I got into poker so heavily. Next thing you know, I wasn't looking at the cards. I was looking at the young girls walking around. Right? So my lifestyle all of a sudden is permitting me to do anything and everything I want. And you just shut up because I'm providing for you. And if you don't like it, there's the door. Yeah, guys, that's me. Okay. I want you to see the level of honesty here. This is not, I'm not trying to, minimize how intense this should be in your life. I mean, if anything, God, help me with this. Take this from me. I can't do anything about it. Can't. Something I've recognized here. I used to think I could when I first came here. Part of my problem. That's why I came in 7.5 years ago and I have a little over a year sobriety today. It's another level of honesty that I have to stare in the face. So it was fun to caroom around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of a tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. So I'm selling drugs, I'm running a business, I own a home, I got multiple trucks, I got some cash in the drawer, I got a little money in the bank. Man, I got it all. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. So hell breaking loose is different for each and every one of us. You think I've been sharing this story with you, and you're like, man, what part of hell broke loose didn't you see? Like, what's happening here? Well, it's different for all of us, and it came in waves for me. You know, part of hell breaking loose was my oldest boy doing so many drugs and getting in this place of just mental pain and anguish and putting him in inpatient rehabilitation at 17 years old. Not being able to pay my mortgage, going from what I just told you to not being able to pay my mortgage, filing bankruptcy, having to do a loan modification because I borrowed so much money on my house in the boom of 08 that I almost lost it all. And I still didn't see the writing on the wall. When we took my son to inpatient rehabilitation, they made me sign a contract that I wouldn't drink for a year and hang it on my refrigerator. It was the most miserable year of my life. I blamed him. I blamed her. I blamed everybody around me. But I did it to prove to you that I'm better than you. And this is how you need your life. Not recognizing that all my children were doing is what they were watching me do their whole life. And I wonder why they can't sustain a relationship. I wonder why my youngest son is now in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking these steps right here with us. I wonder why my oldest son is still single at 34 years old. Wonder why he's angry half the time. Wonder why they hate me half the time. Wonder why my wife don't trust me as far as she can throw me. Well, see, coming in here and making amends and doing the step didn't fix any of that. Gave me a little bit of freedom. It gave me a little bit of truth to see that it's all been me. But man, the pain in that is so ongoing and it just has to continue. These are the places that we try to get to and walk to through doing this work to find out why we've been killing ourselves, putting these substances, whatever they are in our life, these things that are dragging us down that we cannot control, or why we're here and we're removed of those things, but we just don't feel right. Why are we looking for more? What's really going on? And in order to see that, we're going to have to dig really, really deep. Part of that digging is to recognize these similarities with Bill Wilson. So after one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from the hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to the death from towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. See, all this turmoil in my life, all of these failures in my life, I would never give up. I'm the guy that is never going to let it beat me. And I always go back to the drinking and drugging because that's my solution and that's what's going to save me. And I'm going to prove to you that I can be beaten down and get back up and be stronger and be better. I don't know how many times I refinanced this house, the reason why I almost lost this house, and then got right back into the same trouble. Just using this money that I didn't even exist, putting my family in jeopardy and in debt. One of the biggest benefits of coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, working these steps and going through this process has been the ability to relieve myself and my family of debt. Like, my God, to finally grow up. I'm 50 years old. That just happened a few years ago. I would not jump. I never will give up. I am not a failure, because if you think I'm a failure, then you're not going to like me. You're not going to want to be around me, and you're surely not going to look up to me. And if you don't look up to me, then my self-worth is shit, because I'm no good. Because I'm not better than you. How sick is that? That's my unmanageability in my life that I can see through reading a couple of pages in Bill's story and going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My friends have dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. So every time I'm down. Oh, that determination come. Remember, I'm a leader. I'm strong. I'm never going to give up. I'm not going to jump. And if you don't like what you see, then get out. Get away from me. I'll go find somebody I can control. So I live with this fierce determination. And what I see today is it's all driven by fear. There is no fierce determination. There is a scared little boy in there who doesn't know how to deal with life and people and relationships, and surely is not comfortable in his own skin sober. That's me. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. I had plenty of money left. I thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, living in our accustomed style, I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. So see, I'm just going to show to the world that nothing's going to stop me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents, found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. So about 12 years ago, I've had a torn meniscus in my knee from martial arts years back. I started getting this crazy sciatica. Come to find out, I have two bulging discs. So now I'm drinking, I'm smoking, and I'm taking pain medication. And then that just soared. Part of the reason I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it got so bad. Never drawing a sober breath. My wife began to work at the department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. So I see that today as I reflect. But I have to recognize in my experience, I never acknowledged that before I came here. I never saw that, because that would be weak. So I'm doing all of these things because I want to, because I'm entitled to, because I deserve to, because everybody else around me does it. Never acknowledging the fact that I need it, because it never stopped long enough apart from the 1 year that my son was in inpatient rehab. Now, granted, that didn't mean I stopped smoking weed. I just didn't drink for a year. And probably any other drugs I could get my hands on. So I never saw it as a necessity because I was never removed enough, long enough to see how uncomfortable it really made me feel. I didn't ever feel like that till I came in here. Then I got to see how it was a necessity in my life and how uncomfortable life is when you took it away. Bathtub gin and 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my bills at the bars and the delicatessens. So after almost losing my home, I still have a business. Can't sustain that. Go back to work for somebody and trying my best. Any deal I can do, any way I can get money in the pocket, groceries in the fridge. I remember going to the grocery store with the family and literally I'm pretty good with math. So everything that went in that cart, I had it added up before we went to the cashier. There were times where we had to put half of the stuff back. And I mean, this is years after having a business and buying a home and thinking I'm the shit. Anything it took. And I still didn't see it. So this goes on endlessly. I began to wake in early every morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by a half dozen bottles of beer were required if I were to eat any breakfast. I still have a hard time today eating breakfast. And if I do, I don't eat until, unless I'm meeting with some fellas and we're scheduled around 7 or something. But aside from that, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, I'm not eating anything till about 9 o'clock. All I've ever done in the past is wake up at 4, get ready for work, hit the bong about 5 times by 5 a.m. before I even get in my truck, take the weed with me, go to work, and then by about noon, go get a tall boy, go through the rest of my day, and then I'm really off and running on my way home. That's how I functioned. Then I started combining the pain medication with that. Because I needed it. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. And there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. I never really had periods of sobriety. I don't know how long it will take in life to renew my wife's hope. I know she's still here. I thank God for that. I don't get to dictate how that goes. And that's one of the scary, hard truths about this process. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. So I told you guys how I almost lost the home. We didn't pay the mortgage for 18 months. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. So my son was in a major, my oldest son, the one that I adopted when he was 3, a major, major car accident. He was actually in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was 18 years old after he got out of the inpatient treatment program. He was in a car headed on the 8 West Freeway here in San Diego, went off the embankment, rolled 8 times in an old Ford Taurus with the seatbelt that is automatic and just goes over your lap. You know, that old school, you open the door and it goes down. Well, that wasn't working properly, broke his neck, almost died. Staples in his head, staples in his ear. We go through my insurance policy because I have a business. I got a $1 million policy. After all is said and done, he gets awarded $424,000. What do I do? Say, well, son, if it wasn't for my insurance policy, you would have got $115,000. That was the max. Because that's what most people are insured for, $100,000. That's what the driver had. So I'm going to pay the medical bills, give you the 115, and I'm going to take the rest. I justified that. My wife and I took $250,000 from that kid. What? Yeah. That's my thinking. I'm going to go try making amends for that. And we'll talk about that and how that worked in my life when we get to our amends here. It's a very interesting story. So we were up and down. All of a sudden, now we're on top of the world. Within a year, boom, right back to where we were. I woke up and this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There'd been no fight. So in 2018, I'd start telling my wife, I'm going to recovery. I'm going for me. Within 14 days, I'm getting high again. I'm not drinking. I went a really long time without drinking. I was getting high the whole time. It was eating me alive. But I'd tell my sponsor about it. Then he wouldn't give me a token. Then I got resentful. Then I got humble. Then I announced to everybody that I was a newcomer. And I told them the story. And my wife's watching this vicious cycle in my life of going to recovery, lying to people, smoking pot when I get home, becoming miserable, spiritually broken, starting as a newcomer again over and over and over. That happened 6 times in 7 years. And there was no fight, by the way, in my mind. I had already decided I was going to do it. A lot of my unmanageability I have recognized while I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't recognize that I had a disease. I didn't care. I didn't want to do anything about it. And I never tried to stop before I came in here. I thought my life was the way it's supposed to be because it was better than my IV drug using dad, my divorced 4 times mom, and my brother who can't stop drinking himself. So I'm on top of the world. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder. And I started to wonder that here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. What am I doing? Why can't I get this? Am I crazy? Not again. Do I have to tell these people I'm a newcomer again? What's happening? Renewing my resolve, I tried again. And if any of you have ever been in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that pain and what it feels like. God bless each and every one of you who haven't had to experience that. And thank God for you because you're an inspiration to guys like me that show me that this is possible. So confidence began to be replaced with cocksuredness. And that happened this last time. I had 1 year and 8 months. And I was about to start a workshop. And I had 25, that for some reason they were all women. We were going to do it in person. We just announced it. It was here in San Diego. And I started taking the pain medication again. I smoked some weed on New Year's Eve. I went and confessed to my inner circle of about 5 men. And it was so painful and so humiliating. I could not take it. The cocksuredness that took over and this confidence that I was gaining that, yeah, I can really do this, man. I almost got 2 years. It just destroyed me. And that was January of 2024. And I just turned my back on all of you guys. I disappeared until June. And that is where I relate to when Bill talks about his last bock, God willing. You know, I told my sponsor that if I go out again, dude, I don't know that I'll make it back. And he looked right back at me and he said, there you go again, Jason, playing God. You don't know what God has in store for you. And you need to be ready and willing to accept whatever comes. And if he wants you to drink again and go break you down a little more so you truly surrender, then that's something that you're going to have to accept. And it's the scariest thing I ever heard. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar asking myself how it happened. That's how I felt this last time. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. And that's exactly how I felt as soon as I was off and running again. And I wasn't going to admit it, and I wasn't going to try and fight it. Just going to allow it to destroy me. Because I couldn't humble myself enough to pick myself back up and ask God for the strength and the courage to get back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down the early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. The morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? There were times before I ever came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I contemplated suicide. Fights with my wife. Medicine cabinet full of pain medication. I knew where I was going. I knew I was going to take the whole bottle. I knew exactly how it was going to happen. No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that, so two bottles and oblivion. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window for the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my matters to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. That's the place that I got to prior to coming in here on June 5th of 2024. The mental torture was so hellish. And I'll talk a little bit more of that when we get over here to page 8. A doctor came with heavy sedative. The next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. The combination soon landed me on the rocks. And that's what got me initially through the doors in 2018. I remember Tramadol, Percocet, Bud Light, and weed, all in excessive amounts, screaming and yelling at my oldest boy because he went missing in Mexico for a week. We hired a lawyer to try and find him, private investigator. He was dodging us, doing drugs, and I blamed everything on him, all of my problems, everything that was going on. Screaming and yelling at him, saying things that I wouldn't even say to my worst enemy. And something snapped. I went down to the wood pile, sat down, drank that last beer, cried and begged God for help, and went into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for myself. I had taken my kids there. I had taken my brother there. I had taken my father there, but I'd never truly gone for myself. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I would eat little or nothing when drinking and was 40 pounds underweight. I wrote a little note here. Rock bottom is a firm foundation. So as you guys are contemplating your rock bottom and how you relate to Bill and his story, do your best to be gentle with yourself. You have to be honest, but be gentle with yourself. Remember that we do have a disease. And allow this rock bottom that you're recognizing to become a firm foundation for growth, a firm foundation, a real beginning. And the more honest and truthful we are, that foundation will have no cracks. That foundation will have no weakness. I fell victim to having cracks in my foundation here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it led me out the doors. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. So now Bill's finally going to a hospital to get help. Under so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. And that was Dr. Silkworth, which we talked about last week, who let Bill understand that he's suffering from this disease of the body and the mind. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. So I get to recognize that now that I gained this self-knowledge about my disease and understand why I've never had any control, even though other aspects of my life, although not done properly, no true emotional connections, I still display this level of willpower and determination that would get me something if I wanted it. But I couldn't apply that to alcohol and drugs. It relieved me, or my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. And we were talking about self-knowledge last night in our group, about the importance of self-knowledge when it comes to understanding our disease, utilizing that knowledge and our own experience with it to help somebody else, to open the door to them, understanding their own alcoholism and their own addiction and what's going on in their life. But that's how far it goes, and it has nothing to do with the ability for me to remain sober. So it's important for me to decipher that little paradox. Self-knowledge is very important as I move forward. It enables me to help other people through my own honesty and my own experience and my own understanding. But it can do nothing when it comes to sobriety, especially in the long term. But it was not, for that fateful day came when I drank once more. So see, Bill's going in and out, in and out. He's recognizing this problem. He's going to the hospital. He cannot stop. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker of the asylum. It did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. And I felt that as I walked through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first day or two, I was so desperate and broken, but as time passed, that's all I felt was a blow to my pride, and I'm a failure. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. So there I sat in the chair in Alpine, California, in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I've seen my father, and I sent my kids, and I sent my brother, and I told myself I would never end up there. Because I'm better than that. And now I was to plunge into the dark, join that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. No way, not in my mind. That's been an attitude that has kept me from being in a recovered state all this time. This attitude of, this is weak, and I will never show weakness. I can't fail, and this is nothing but failure. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity, quicksand stretched all around me, stretched around me in all directions I had met my match. So on June 4th of 2024, after 6 months of running one more time, within that 6 month period, I told him, so now I have all this knowledge about myself. I've been through the steps multiple times. I've taken people through the steps. I'm attempting to turn my back on this power of God because I'm just going to ignore it right now and I'm going to do my thing. I got diagnosed with cancer in my lip. So they cut a chunk out, a wedge out of the corner of my lip, stitched me up. My dad dies at 67 of pneumonia. They intubate him. He's there for 21 days. They say, we can't do this anymore. You've got to make a choice. We're either going to do this tracheotomy in his neck and then you're going to have to take care of him forever, or we're going to pull this tube and he's going to pass on peacefully. I'm a mess. My brother's there to help. My wife's there. My sister-in-law's there. We don't know what to do. My dad's an alcoholic addict for 50 years. Suffering, dying before his time, living in Section 8 housing, living a life that none of us would even really consider living today. Very unhealthy, very unsafe. So we decide to pull the tube. And my father proceeds to live on for another 12 days of torture. In hospice, no food, just dying. I feel responsible for this. I feel like I played a part to this. Did I make the wrong decision? This whole time I'm getting loaded. The pain's flaring up and my sciatica's flaring up like it hasn't in years. My knees just screaming. I'm in all this spiritual pain, all this physical pain. I can't take it anymore. I'm trying to go one day without. I can't go without. I come home from work, I sit on the porch on June 4th, and I tell my wife, if this doesn't stop, I'm going to go in that bedroom and put that gun in my mouth. And that's how I felt. And I'd never been to that point before. And I'd also never experienced what I had heard people talking about in the rooms of it worked until it didn't work anymore. Because it always worked for me, I thought. But at that moment, being loaded and being in that kind of pain, I acknowledged how it wasn't working for me. And it scared the shit out of me. And it made me suicidal. Through the grace of God, dumped out the pills, poured out the beer, went to bed, called a friend the next day. Went to him crying, got back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was June 5th, 2024. So that's what my bitter morass of self-pity looked like recently, the quicksand looked like recently, meeting my match looked like recently. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital, broken man. Fear sobered me up a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. Oh, so true. So true. All the darkness that I've been sharing with you guys. And next week I get to share with you some of the stories of recovery, some of the stories of peace, some of the stories of grace, that have occurred in my life since what I'm sharing with you today. Tonight's ugly. What I'm telling you guys is ugly. You know? That's the darkness before the dawn. And I have to recognize that. I have to see it. Because that gives me faith that there is a God. And faith that he will work for me. Although a part of me wants to continue to fight that. I got to recognize that. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debacle. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. What a beautiful promise after everything I just shared with you guys. My God, is that real? Is that possible? Yeah, it is. Work in progress, take a lifetime, but totally possible. That's my experience. I will fail, I will falter, and I will be set back. But I can know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that's incredibly more wonderful as time passes in my life. I can be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence, the spiritual dimension. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. So that's where I'm going to stop. Because after that, Bill begins to talk about his journey of recovery. So it is important for us to recognize the physical element in that portion of Bill's story. How he put it in his body, could not control the amount he took. There was obviously some mental obsession involved. He continued to go back to it against his own will. And he will finish off his story with what it took, what he succumbed to, surrendered to, and the process he went through in order to become recovered. Because this book is about how 100 men and women have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And Bill is one of those 100. But you and I can be part of the millions. How's that? That is awesome. There is a course of action. There is an attitude. And there are ideas that have to be abandoned. But tonight we sit in the spot of recognizing the pain we cause, the unmanageability in our lives, the madness that we live through, thought was normal, justified, the way we treated others, the way we treated ourselves, and the complete inability to control the amount of poison that we were putting in our body once we started. And that's what we really look at for this first part of our first step. So that's assignment 3. And next week will be assignment 4, which is the second half of Bill's story. I will continue to encourage you guys to make your homework groups. Read 84 through 88 each day. Try and take a little bit of time, just quiet by yourself. Invite God, whatever that looks like for you. We all notice the group kind of getting smaller in the workshop. I'm going to pray and meditate on the level of recordings that I send. Absolutely. Any one of you want this recording? You want to revisit it? No problem. But I am going to begin to contemplate sending recordings to people that don't show up on a weekly basis. But please understand that you're going to get a lot more out of your group. You're going to get a lot more personal attention, experience talked about, interaction and intimacy than you will here because you're just listening to me. But I would hope that through my vulnerability, my honesty, and my own experience that there could be a level of inspiration that's generated to say, you know what, wow, I want to dig a little deeper. That's kind of the goal here. I mean, because when it comes to inventory and fifth steps and amends, I mean, I'm going to be dealing with four people that are in my group. That's just kind of how this whole thing's designed, because there's not enough time for everybody. I do want to make it clear that I am here for each and every one of you. Anytime you want to call, you want to have one-on-one text, whatever, I'm open to anything. I love you guys. I respect the fact that you show up. It means a lot to me. So with that, man, I'm gonna say a prayer for us. Oh, thank you, God, for allowing me to be vulnerable, allowing me to be honest. Please help some level of open-mindedness and inspiration, some realizations, some truth to be found in each and every one of our hearts. Help us to continue on this journey, to stay put, to be gentle with ourselves, to do our best to be in the present, to take time to commune with you, to recognize the necessity, to lift all of these horrible things and ways that we've lived our life up to you, because we have no power over them. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your grace. Thank you for this meeting. And may the Lord bless you and protect you. May the Lord smile on you and be gracious to you. May the Lord show you his favor and give you his peace. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Jason.
You guys are welcome, Jason, man. Love you guys.
Thank you. I appreciate, you know, so what it allows me to do is then go back through Bill's story, and then the way that, because I didn't really understand how I was supposed to say the similarities, but then I could just write my story too based on how he kind of reads this story, even though my story is different, but it triggers thoughts for me about how the similarities were, you know, I mean, so that's where my journal comes in at. Okay.
That's right.
I appreciate your talk. I think you did a great job. At first I was kind of mad at you for being a woman, but guess what? Then I said, well, no shit, I did that shit too, you know, but I did it
That's
in reverse,
right.
you know, so I just, thank you so much. I'm glad to be in your group and I appreciate it. I contacted Sarah, and because I have your number, not that I've called you, I don't call, but just in case something comes up, it'd be nice to be able to text Sarah or whatever to tell her I might not be here, but I'm going to be there. But,
okay.
So hopefully she'll get that. And if not, I'll see her next week and I'll talk to her myself. And the other thing is the four ladies that are in our group. Why don't we, like, I want to start a group chat. You know, like sometimes, you know, somebody might have an idea, a question or something that they want to just group chat. Everybody doesn't have to participate, but even though it comes to you, I mean, I'm 65 years old. I don't have time to sit here and chat to you all damn day. So I think that gives us a better connection too. I'm just saying, here's some ideas that I think that would like really connect the sponsor groups or the workshop groups. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So, Kim, I'm talking about.